Welcome to Based AF. I'm sociologist Ashley Frawley. Every day, we're bombarded with claims about new social problems that we're supposed to worry about. We have only so much compassion, care, and critical attention that we can devote to these. Why does an issue like this?
We just want to educate people and want to show people, especially short people, that heightism exists, that people who are short are victims of discrimination.
Get this kind of response.
Marcos, as a black man, when you hear the strife and adversity this gentleman's overcome with the height issue, can you please let him know when the next march is? Can you please let him know?
But an issue like this makes the front pages and mainstream news in the 1980s.
What Teresa had to endure is bad enough, but it's far from being an isolated case. We found strong evidence that scores of children in Britain are victims of these satanic rituals. But what is the attraction of these cults, and how are people lured into them?
This is sociologist Joel Best, professor of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware and the world's leading expert on social problems.
This is all about packaging. It's all about assembling claims in a way that will persuade other people. And you know, you can watch this happen. You know, there are social movements that are out there, and they'll be pounding their head against the wall for a long time, and then all of a sudden, you know, things change and they start to get attention. You know, women's rights, there've been people complaining about women injustices toward women for, you know, at least a couple of centuries, probably vastly longer than that. And all of a sudden, in the late 20th century, this begins to gain traction. And I think it's a matter of being able to make claims that are interesting, that are effective, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that heightism has a real problem because, heightism is seen as somewhat comic. My father was a short man, and he was convinced that he had been held back by his height, and maybe that was true, but you know, saying that to people, you know, they're just not likely to take it seriously. Now, it's important to understand that 100 years ago, a black man who complained about that kind of mistreatment was also not likely to be taken seriously. You know, so it's possible that you could, if you had a glaring example, if you had, you know, something that you could really hang the campaign on, maybe you could change people's attitudes about heightism and make it a social problem. And certainly it's possible if you have something that's melodramatic enough, like claims about a great satanic cabal that's killing tens of thousands of people in human sacrifices every year. That's dramatic enough. That's eye-popping. It may be ridiculous, but it is compelling enough to get attention. So I think this is all about packaging.
So the main difference between a problem formulation or construction that fails to take off and one that sort of runs rampant, is it just about rhetoric and packaging, or is it something more?
Yeah, there are lots of things that can go wrong. This is really true. We have this campaign in the United States to do something about dreamers. Dreamers are people who were brought illegally to the United States with their families, at some point, and they've grown up in the United States, and they've gone to high school and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And they think of themselves as Americans and they have no legal standing. And this creates all kinds of problems for them. And so there was a campaign to start to do something about this. And they were literally planning to hold a big press conference, you know, to really draw attention to this issue on September 12th, 2001. Okay. And, you know, of course, on September 11th, 2001, you have the terrorist attacks, the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and all that stuff. And, you know, that just completely monopolized public attention. You know, the war on terror became the only thing that people were focused on, really for weeks, if not months. And the poor dreamers, if they'd scheduled it for September 9th, or September 10th, maybe they would have gotten some attention, but probably not, because even then they would have been pushed off the front page instantly once it happened. You know, timing has a lot to do with this. I mean, there's a lot going on. And so we can look back and we can say, okay, and most social movements have histories where, people will say, okay, there's this long period where we were butting our heads against the wall. And it was really tough to get anybody to take it seriously. And now, for these reasons, things seem to catch on. And, I think that there's a lot of variation from problem to problem in terms of what those factors are.
I think a lot of people, for me, this sounds, quite straightforward, that something moves on to what we call the public agenda for all sorts of reasons, a good rhetorical formulation, people will organize around it, timing. But I think to the average person, they think something has made it into the news media on the front page because it's the most harmful or pressing problem.
Yeah, or it's just the one they're hearing about. Most people are not reading very far into it. If we had newspapers, they weren't reading very far into the newspaper to begin with. The headline is what's great. The thing that always fascinates me about going to London in the United States, with a couple of rare exceptions, cities have one newspaper, and of course this newspaper has gotten vastly smaller, and it's shrunk and so on and so forth. But the thing about London is it used to be, it's probably like the News of the World is gone. I don't know what else is still there, but it used to be when I first started going to London that there were, like 12 national newspapers, and the headlines were just wild. And I was experimenting, going to I'd pick up a different paper each day. And, they're all doing the same thing. They're all telling these dramatic social problem stories. Some of them have a slant to the left or a slant to the right or an upscale market or a lower scale market. But, alarm is the general thing. And you go by a newsstand and there were, people had inked in, the dramatic headlines of the day and so on. We're interested to think about that, particularly in a competitive marketplace. And that's less true in the United States, where people just aren't getting news from newspapers the way that they used to. But and they probably aren't really, they're aware that their favorite news show is giving different news than some other channel's news show. But they probably don't care about that very much. In the good old days, when there were three networks in the United States, there were actually studies complaining that they gave exactly this, they covered the same stories, often with the same film clips and so on and so forth. And people used to say, gee, wouldn't it be great if we had different voices? And now, of course, we've got multiple news channels in the United States, at least, which carry very different, I take very different ideological positions and unshamefully promote stories that really aren't going to get anyplace else.
I suppose people probably have in mind things like clickbait headlines, right? So everyone is competing, not everyone. You have this very accelerated fragmentation of the media that's been going on for decades, but online it's become quite competitive. So people are sort of ratcheting it up, right? Well, their pet issue is the worst possible issue, and this is a genocide that we're all going to die. And it becomes quite a dangerous sort of marketplace of ideas where everyone, there becomes more and more polarization around every idea.
The key thing that's happened from my point of view is that we have increased the number of places where you can get news. Okay. 1985, not that long ago, most Americans were getting their television from broadcast. Okay. That is, they had an antenna on their house and the signals were traveling through the ether, wherever the signal still. And, you know, they were not, on cable. Okay. So, that meant that your television probably received about 10 channels, and you probably, unless you lived in a really big city, probably only had 5 or 6. Okay. And what's happened is we go to cable, we go to satellite. You know, I can turn on my TV and I have literally hundreds of choices. Okay. So the audience is fragmented. In the good old days, it used to be that about 30% of the audience in the United States watched ABC, 30% watched CBS, 30% watched NBC. And that would be true any given hour. And if you had a big hit, your show was getting 33% of the audience. Okay. Mm. You know, so that was what was going on. Walter Cronkite, who's a famous newsman on CBS in the 1960s and I think into the 1970s, he used to pull in about close to 30 million viewers every night. Okay. And he used to end his news broadcasts, and that's the way it was. It was like the voice of God speaking to you. Today, Fox News, which is the cable news channel that is most notorious and has higher ratings than its competition. Somebody like Sean Hannity, who's probably the biggest name on Fox News today, on a good night, he probably tops 3 million viewers. So his audience is 10%. Of what Walter Cronkite's was every night. And he's a big deal in the United States. What's happened is you give people hundreds of options, and most of the time they're not going to watch the news. They're going to watch Golf Channel or whatever. And so there's this proliferation of ideas. Similarly, in the good old days, we had 3 news magazines that came out every week that millions of people subscribe to. Those stop being commercially viable. Most cities, you have 1 or possibly 2 newspapers, 1 in the morning and 1 in the evening. They probably are owned by the same people, produced in the same building. Now you go on the internet and God, what do you want? Okay. if you like to have sex with the animals, okay, you can find other people on the internet who like to have sex with animals. That's maybe in the dark web. There are going to be people like that, and they're going to communicate with one another. And they're going to tell each other, "Hey, we're the ones who really love animals," that's a phenomenon. So we have fragmented. It's very difficult to know where most people are, okay, because there's no longer a place where most people are, in a shared audience together.
So this is an interesting question for democracy, I suppose, an interesting development for democracy. But what does it mean for social problems and the public agenda?
Well, I think it means that it used to be pretty much impossible, to get coverage on national television in the United States. I mean, back when you had 3 networks, it was very, very difficult to break in. Today, anybody can be on national television.
Right. So, the whole justification for this, though, for the lockdowns and so on, is to protect the NHS, to stop the NHS from being overwhelmed. And now suddenly we can do away with, we have tons of capacity to suddenly do away with all of these people.
I find that funny that that's actually portrayed as like a progressive thing, like moderate your desires. Too much want makes you discontent. I don't understand how that's a leftist idea. If society constantly thwarts your attempts, like look around, we've got like abundance that our ancestors could never have dreamed of. And we're constantly being told, can't have that.
Amazon warehouses are really the mills of the 21st century. Although they are highly mechanized, the work is extremely demanding, extremely fast-paced, and there's little time to sort of like think. You are just an appendage of the machines. And then the threat is, of course, that if you demand too much, then you will simply be replaced by more machinery. And I just say, good. You know, why should Amazon workers accept poor pay and poor conditions, essentially subsidizing technological backwardness by accepting these bad conditions?
You know, or global internet. I mean, you know, really anybody can do this. And so, you know, we have no idea. We have all this language about going viral and influencers and TikTok stars and all this kind of stuff. And it's very easy to make social problems claims. It's increasingly hard to get general widespread agreement about what, you know, claims are. And you see this in surveys all the time where you'll ask people what are their concerns. And these things have always been wrong. It's very common if you ask people in the United States, what is the state of American education? American education is just terrible. It is just awful. Okay. If you say to them, how do you feel about your kid's school? Oh, my kid's school is great. You know, it's outstanding. Okay. What's Congress like? Congress is a sinkhole. Okay. How do you feel about your congressional representative? Oh, great. Great. Okay. You know, what's the economy like? The economy is, you know, dismal. How are your personal finances?
Fine.
Right? and I think part of this is just the way that we consume news. The news is, you know, news is not going to be happy news. News is always going to be, you know, upsetting news. That's what's newsworthy. And so you get this constant drumbeat that the rest of the world is going to hell. Now, your family, your school, your congressman, your finances, that may be okay, but you realize the rest.
Yeah, and I suppose this is kind of produced by the need to convince other people that your problem is the most important problem. And then everybody's doing that. So what happens is you open a newspaper and it's just page after page of the world going to hell in a handbasket. And then we have a word for this as it goes online, doom scrolling. You're just going through and looking at how the world is getting worse and worse. And then they're like, why do young people have so much anxiety? One of the themes that you've written quite a lot about is statistics and the kind of portrayal of statistics. And I really love your books on this because they're really funny also. So the sort of mutant statistic that you begin, I can't remember if it's the first book on stats about the number of gunshot victims.
Yeah.
Again, it's a great story. I remember it, you know, about this mutant stat. So can you tell me, what is the worst statistic you have ever come across?
Well, the one that I say is the worst, it's certainly still got to be a contender, is I had a graduate student, it's really a true story, it's all true, a graduate student who was writing a dissertation prospectus and started off with a quotation. The quotation was,
every year since 1950, the number of American children gunned down has doubled. When I read the quotation, I assumed the student had made an error in copying it. I went to the library and looked up the article the student had cited. There, in the journal's 1995 volume, was exactly the same sentence. Every year since 1950, the number of American children gunned down has doubled. This quotation is my nomination for a dubious distinction. I think it may be the worst, that is, the most inaccurate, social statistic ever. What makes this statistic so bad? Just for the sake of argument, let's assume that the number of American children gunned down in 1950 was 1. If the number doubled each year, there must have been 2 children gunned down in 1951, 4 in 1952, 8 in 1953, and so on. By 1960, the number would have been 1,024. By 1965, it would have been 32,768. In 1965, the FBI identified only 9,960 criminal homicides in the entire country, including adult as well as child victims. In 1970, the number would have passed 1 million. In 1980, 1 billion, more than 4 times the total U.S. population in that year. Only 3 years later, in 1983, the number of American children gunned down would have been 8.6 billion, about twice the Earth's population at the time. Another milestone would have been passed in 1987, when the number of gunned-downed American children, 137 billion, would have surpassed the best estimates for the total human population throughout history, 10 billion. By 1995, when the article was published, the annual number of victims would have been over 35 trillion. A really big number, of a magnitude you rarely encounter outside economics or astronomy. Thus, my nomination, estimating the number of American child gunshot victims in 1995 at 35 trillion, must be as far off, as hilariously, wildly wrong, as a social statistic can be.
I looked at it, I thought that's ridiculous, you know, and I actually got up and went out of my office and went to the library because this was footnoted, you know, and I wanted to get the correct quotation because obviously the student copied this down wrong and I was going to beat the student over the head with this. You know, or, you know, be careful, et cetera. And I found the source for this. And, you know, the student had copied the quote correctly. And so then I wrote the author and I said, you know, impressionable young people read this stuff. This is obviously wrong. What are you talking? And he said, well, I got this from the Children's Defense Fund. And I thought, oh God, I hope that's true because the Children's Defense Fund was this organization which had a lot of visibility at one point about, you know, talking about children's issues. And so I went to I found the Children's Defense Fund piece of literature that he had cited. And, you know, what the Children's Defense Fund had said was that since 1950, the number of children gunned down has doubled. In other words, it had doubled once. But the way guy rephrased it in his thing, it was doubling and redoubling every year. So if it was 1 in 1950, it would have been 2 in 1951 and 4 in 1952. And when you do that, you know, there's an old fable about this, numbers go up really, really quickly.
So why do stats have a tendency, and I have to admit this as well, that I teach a section on bad stats and we have a really fun time and the students will laugh at all the mutant stats that I've and correlations treated causally that I have found all over the internet. And it's a great lesson, but inevitably every year I mutate a stat myself. And I, you know, even though I know what I'm talking about, I'm a sociologist, I've studied this stuff, I've written about it. I mutate the stats and I found a mutant stat in my own book and I caught it just in the proof stage. So why does this happen?
I think, you know, numbers are tricky, you know, we all know a little bit and we're all a little bit innumerate, which is the mathematical equivalent of illiteracy. You know, but it's also the case that, you know, if we hear a number from somebody who's taking a position that we disagree with, okay, we become analytic tigers and think about, oh, you know, that's clearly wrong because this, that, you know, what's a sample for this, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But when we hear a statistic from somebody who's making a point that we agree with, we tend to be much more forgiving. I mean, you know, maybe it's not, that's not a perfect statistic, but you know, it's good enough. You know, it makes the point, you know, the point that we really need to make. And so we turn off our critical facilities. It's very easy for any of us to do this. Okay. You know, the hardest part of critical thinking is to be critical of your own ideas. okay? Because you know that you're right. You've got confidence. You believe your position is correct and well reasoned and so on and so forth. And you know, it's very easy to be critical of people that you disagree with, and harder to be critical of your own thoughts. And you got to watch that. That's one of the great key lessons in anything that you're doing is, you know, smoking my own supply?
How to create a mutant statistic in 5 easy steps. Step 1, be innumerate. Innumeracy is the mathematical equivalent of illiteracy. It refers to difficulty grasping numbers and calculations. Members of the public might be innumerate, but often the people making claims about social problems are no better. They may misunderstand what a number means, how it was measured, and what sampling methods were used to create it. Step 2. Be committed to the cause. Enthusiasm for a cause can lead advocates to mangle a stat. Any big number will do, after all. It's a big problem, and we need to get the word out. Others sympathetic to the cause might hear these mangled stats, be impressed by them, and repeat them. Like a game of telephone, over time, the context gets lost and the stat can get even more mangled along the way. People in positions of authority can give added credibility to the mangled stat. Through widespread repetition, a mangled stat can become part of the facts about the issue that few think to question. For example, back in the 1990s, advocates seeking to raise awareness of eating disorders estimated that 150,000 American women were affected by anorexia, which could lead to death. Later advocates mangled this stat, saying that 150,000 women per year died from anorexia in the US. This was a dramatic, eye-catching stat, and considerably more than the actual number, which was, at the time, about 70 per year. It was also about 3 times more than the total number of women in the US aged 15 to 44 who died for any reason. If you don't want to mangle a stat, it's worthwhile to know numbers like this. How many people of various demographics die every year from any cause? But most people don't know these statistics, so the impressive number is repeated. Step 3. Generalize. Take a number that applies to a specific group and apply it to some broader population that it may not represent. Numbers derived from observations of specific and possibly more highly affected populations can be generalized to the entire population. For instance, social workers tend to see families who experience high rates of certain problems. Indeed, it is often these problems that bring families to their attention in the first place. But generalizing the rates of problems they see in their practice to the experience of all families can be an instance of inappropriate generalization. Broad or inconsistent definitions can also distort statistics. When broad definitions of a crime are used, they can create large numbers. But this can obscure enormous variation in what's being counted. Changes in definitions and measurement strategies can also lead to rises, producing the impression that the problem is getting worse. Hate crime stats are a particularly notorious offender, being subject to enormous variation in terms of definition and measurement practices over time, as well as waves of encouragement for the public to report incidents, which can range from minor online interactions to physical violence. Step 4. Transform. A statistic describing something specific can be transformed to refer to something else. This happened in our anorexia example, where the number of people affected became the number of people who died. Something that begins as an estimate can be misunderstood and repeated as though it was an established fact, presumably based on good evidence. Some stats can be produced by making unwarranted leaps in logic. For example, reporting of homicides often includes, at least at the time of reporting, unknown offenders. In the 1980s, advocates trying to raise awareness of serial killers made the logical leap that at least a large portion of homicides with unknown offenders might have been the work of serial killers. This produced estimates that were far too high, so that, for instance, individual serial killers would have to be responsible for 100 victims per year. But these produced impressive numbers and caught the attention of policymakers. Such large estimates meant that something had to be done. Step 5. Be confused. Sometimes very complex statistics can be mangled because people just don't understand them. A correct but difficult to understand stat can become an easily understood but wildly inaccurate one. One of the more well-known offenders is the risk ratio. Here's an example from the U.S.-based campaign group Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. In the ad, a man is shown reaching for a plate of bacon rashers while an ominous church bell tolls. As he goes to eat the bacon, he trips and falls out an open window. An on-screen stat claims that 2 strips per day increases the risk of colorectal cancer by 18%. But what does that 18% mean? Does that mean you, individually, are 18% more likely to get colorectal cancer if you eat bacon? Is your poor breakfast choice the equivalent of throwing yourself out a window? At the time of this campaign in 2018, about 4.49% of men developed colorectal cancer. A few extra strips of bacon per day would raise that to 5.3%, so just under one more case per 100 people. That's still an avoidable rise, but it somehow sounds less scary than 18%, and never mind some of the dubious ways in which data is collected from dietary studies. But that's precisely why risk ratios are often used to communicate risk. They're a lot more impressive. So, be enumerate, committed to the cause, use unwarranted generalizations, transform, and confuse the meanings of complex stats, and you too can mangle statistics like a pro.
A number is a very specific thing, okay? You know, somebody has counted something, and you need to, and ideally, you would ask yourself, when you hear a number, you'd ask yourself, who counted that? How did they go about counting? Why did they go about counting? Why are they using this particular number? Etc. You have to kind of think about this. And, you know, sometimes, like, you know, an example that I really like is, and this is kind of an old example, but there used to be people who would talk about the number of gay teen suicides. Okay, and the point was that it's difficult to be gay, and this is demonstrated by the number of gay kids that kill themselves. Now, you'd see a number for that. Where could that number possibly come from? Okay, how could anybody count gay teen suicides? Okay, it's not like death certificates list sexual orientation on them. Okay, how would you identify? And you know, right away, you realize that this is a number that you know, if you can't answer the question, how could I count that? Then probably the people who are throwing the number around aren't able to count it either.
Is there anything that when we hear a number, there's anything about it that can make us question it?
I'll tell you the two things that I think really ought to grab your attention right off the bat are big round numbers. Okay. In the United States, it is remarkable how often God packages social problems in millions. Okay. So, you know, 1 million cases of elder abuse, there are 2 million missing children, there are 3 million homeless, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. My favorite example of this in some ways is each year a billion birds are killed flying into windows. How would you count those things? That's a sign that somebody's guessing, okay? Mm. I mean, it just seems kind of, you know, so a big round number is a thing. But the second thing I think is very important, and I use myself as an example of this. If I'm reading something and my reaction is, holy cow, I had no idea things were that bad, they probably are. You know, that's probably a number that has been produced, you know, to make me have that reaction. If you have that reaction, it's certainly time to sit back and say, okay, how do we know?
And does advocacy research play a role in some of this tendency to produce these big numbers and scary claims and causal relationships between things that on closer examination are pretty difficult to prove?
Of course. You want to highlight whatever issue it is that you know heightism or whatever, and somebody is going to ask you, well, how big a problem is this? And And you would like to have the biggest number possible, okay? And, you know, sometimes you can make it up. You can say, you know, you have to remember, if you're an advocate, you're hanging out with other people who probably share your point of view, okay? And you're probably saying to yourself, you know, yeah, you know, this is a problem. This is a big problem. This is a big problem in my life. It's a big problem among the people I know. It's a big problem, right? Well, you know, okay. So if somebody says to you, well, how big is the problem? And someone says, well, here's a big number. And you say, well, this is a big problem. It's a big number. It must be about right. Okay. And you're not really thinking about it, you know? So, you know, when people were running around saying there were 2 million missing children, you know, they were people who thought missing children was a big problem. And they were convinced that was true. And they thought that the 2 million number would get attention. And I don't think they thought they were lying, but they certainly thought their hearts were in the right place by doing that.
In part two, we talk about one of my favorite and, in my opinion, most underappreciated sociologists, Joseph Gusfield. It's from Gusfield that I take the idea of coercive reform, the use of the law to change people's attitudes and values rather than what's usually imagined as the ideal of democracy. People's values change, and we seek to change the law as a response. We also answer the question, should researchers be advocates for the problems that they study? Can this distort research in the public imagination? All of that is on Patreon. If you enjoy these conversations, consider supporting at www.patreon.com/AshleyAFrawley.